ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of EAA's The Green Dot, our podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts today. My name is Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And sitting across from me for his debut on The Green Dot and really sort of a new adventure into his career at EAA is our intern, Ike Lankow. Ike, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, I'm very excited to be here, and I'm sure it's going to be a journey, but I'm looking forward to all the things that the future holds. So,
well, we're so excited to have you. Ike, for those listening, is one of us. He's already diving deep into aircraft mysteries. He solved one of them this morning, which is awesome. So we're having a great time. For those tuning in, the subject today, we're going to talk about an airplane that is near and dear to my heart. Not just because of the aircraft, but because of the people around it. And that is the B-25 Miss Mitchell, a beautifully restored B-25 with the Minnesota wing of the CAF, the Commemorative Air Force. And we have two great ambassadors, not just of that aircraft, but also of the Warbird sort of movement entire. And that is Amy Loria, wing leader of the Minnesota wing of the CAF, along with the executive officer from that squadron, Jim Loria. Guys, welcome. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be
here. Oh, cool. Guys, you know, longtime friends. It's always great when you can, you know, talk to your friends and then you don't realize where you became friends, which is something we always try to figure out of like, how long have we known each other? But we don't really know. And that's kind of part of the fun. How this came to be that I wanted to really talk to you guys is you guys went above and beyond this summer. Helping us with, we had a young gentleman here on the Make-A-Wish program. And I remember one of his things was he wanted to fly specifically in a B-25. That was one of his wish list items. And, you know, you guys just immediately stepped forward when you heard about it and just moved heaven and earth to make this happen and went way above in the way you guys did everything. And I just want to call that out first and foremost, that, what you guys did for that young guy, he's still talking about it.
That's great.
That's awesome.
It was one of those things where, as that was going on, I'm like, wait, why haven't we had them on the green dot yet? So, but I wanted to call that at first that I just remember there was never, you know, because when you operate these aircraft, it comes with a great cost,
right?
You know, you would have the figures more than I do, but it just to turn a blade, it costs money. And I just remember without any hesitation, you guys just ran into the fire and said, yep, we're doing this. And I'm forever grateful for that. And I'm sure he is as well. And, you know, that was one instance. I'm sure you guys do stuff like that all the time. I mean, that is just one example of what you do with this airplane.
Yeah. I mean, we absolutely try to, because we do obviously, you know, incur costs, and being that we're volunteer nonprofit and everything, and it's, you know, always tight, and we're always looking for, you know, how we can get a new engine, get new parts, but you know, stuff like this comes up, and there's really it's nice working with the team that we have, because the pilots that were involved with it, the ops officer, Trevor, everybody just jumped right in, and no one hesitated for a second.
That's fantastic. I remember it. You know, in the what we call the fog of war of air venture, you know, on the backside of planning this big family reunion, you know, I could just remember seeing texts and everything come up that said like, "Yep, we're in." You know, I mean, it was just really a cool breath of fresh air, and really appreciate it. So let's talk a little bit about the airplane.
Sure.
You know, I think a lot of our listeners probably know what a B-25 is. But you know, maybe for those who don't, Jim or Amy, do you guys want to give the Cliff Notes version of what a B-25 is?
I'm gonna let Jim handle that one. He's the mechanic.
B-25 Mitchell bomber. It's a medium bomber. It was used in all theaters of the war. It was used for low-level strafing or more high-altitude bombing, not as high as the B-17, but, you know, its focuses were more, you know, strategic, tactical, you know, so it would attack bridges and troop formations, shipping lanes, focused on everything that, you know, wasn't manufacturing large scale bombing missions. So its big claim to fame was, of course, the Doolittle Raid. It was chosen to take off of the carrier Hornet and bomb Japan by Jimmy Doolittle. And that's where it really became famous. And it's kind of an amazing aircraft on all of the things it was able to do through the war. You know, the different configurations for the nose. So it, you know, had some versions with a 75 millimeter cannon and 450 cals. Some versions, the later ones, the J models, they switched over to an 850 cal nose, and they could add cheek packs along the side with additional 450 cals. They could lock the turret forward, and you know, a lot of firepower coming straight forward at shipping and ground targets. And then they could also put in a glass nose, which is what ours is set up as, and install a Norden bomb site, do bombing missions with it, multiple different options there for bomb sites. Yeah, it was an all around capable bomber, and it could pretty much do everything.
I always wondered, you know, when they came up with the idea of putting the cannon from a Sherman tank in it, if that was like a bar thing where a guy was like, you know, it'd be cool if we put one of those in there, and people were like, hey, man, is everything okay at home?
I have a feeling everything at North American was like that. It just kind of seems like it's like, this would be an awesome idea. And they just
put it around. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, it was a cannon off of a Sherman tank that they were like, yeah, we'll throw that in the nose.
I thought that's a really great idea. What if?
So we hosted a pilot here once who flew one of the cannon-nosed aircraft.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And I asked him about it. I was like, what was it like to fire that gun? And he's like, I swear to you that it stopped the airplane.
Oh,
and he goes, and the reload time was long. And it, you know, and he goes, by the time you were ready to go, you had to go and swing out and make another pass, you know.
Sure.
But he was like, yeah, whenever we fired it, it felt like it stopped the airplane. And that's incredible. Yeah, there was a documentary once, and it was about a different airplane. It was about the Spitfire, but there was a line in there that I loved where somebody said the Spitfire was Britain's way of saying we refuse to be bullied. And I always felt the B-25 was kind of that for the United States with the Doolittle Raid.
Yeah.
That was that airplane and that raid gave a lot of people in this country some hope during a dark time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It really did.
So can you guys tell us a little bit about the history of your example, your airframe?
Yeah, so we our B-25 was donated to us in 1980, and it was a 12-year restoration process. Originally, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, they were going to call it something else, or they were going to model it after a different airplane. They were just going to call it something else. And some of our members at the time were World War II veterans, and one of them was Ray Ostley, who was the crew chief on Miss Mitchell during World War II. And I'm not exactly sure how the story goes, but he was like, well, why don't we, you know, name it after Miss Mitchell and recreate the airplane in her likeness. So after a 12-year restoration process, originally she flew on April 16th or April 18th of 1992. It was almost 50 years to the day of the Doolittle Raid.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they tried to get it close, but I think it was a couple of days off. And I'm sure weather was a factor because Minnesota in April.
Yeah. So. It's winter part two.
Yeah. But it having an airplane that is based off of a real aircraft with real stories of real people has been such an impact, not just for our community, but you know, you were talking about the young gentleman we took for a flight. You know, being able to share the history with people and something that's real that can inspire people has been, I don't know, I don't even have words for it.
Well, and it's amazing that, you know, I know a lot of times we say like, well, you know, young people aren't interested in the Second World War or history and these warbirds. And I mean, I totally disagree. I mean, I'm sitting across from Ike, our intern, and Ike, how old are you?
I'm 18.
Yeah, I mean, and how long have you been in the Warbirds?
Oh, since I was 3.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I mean, just last week I gave a tour to some young people that were really excited to do it. We did a cockpit climb night for teachers in the area. We, you know, there's still a big interest there. I think the big thing is, you know, we need good ambassadors to explain the people stories of why this is so important to you, you know, preserve this. You know, I wouldn't get fired up about a cannon in a Civil War park, but if you start telling me about the people who manned that cannon, you know, then maybe I suddenly do care a little bit more about that.
Right. Yeah.
And you guys are wonderful ambassadors for this program and for this aircraft and really for the industry. Tell us a little bit about how you each got involved in aviation and how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I have, I guess, a long line of family history. Jim does as well. But my specifically with the museum, my grandpa was one of the volunteers in the 80s, and he did the wiring on Miss Mitchell originally. So I grew up kind of hanging around the museum as a kid and got to spend a lot of time with the World War II veterans, which I would not change that for anything on this planet. Like just being able to have that experience with them and be able to keep sharing that with, you know, the next generation of kids that come into the museum. And then Jim and I actually met at the museum and we got married at the museum. And now we are on staff.
Yeah.
We're awesome. we're never going anywhere.
Yeah. Adding to that, your other grandpa was a B-24 gunner, flight engineer. And so he was in Italy during the war too.
Yeah.
So he had family involved in the war. And,
So lots of family ties and history, both to World War II and aviation. My dad was a pilot. Got several family members that were pilots and
private for fun.
Private pilots. And so
that's cool. And you yourself are a pilot.
I am. Yeah. I got my license a couple years ago.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And Jim, how about yourself?
I grew up, my dad worked for Northwest pretty much my whole life. So I was around, he was an engineer, not a flight engineer, paper engineer. And so I grew up around aviation just in general. My parents met at Boeing. They both worked there on 727 project. And so, you know, just I grew up around it. It's kind of weird. My brother did too, but he ended up not at all interested in aviation. I got all of that. Both my grandparents were in World War II. My grandfathers were in World War II, but never saw combat or anything. One was a stateside medic, and the other one was a cook who ended up in Germany post-war, but you know, didn't make it over there during the fighting. So that, you know, militarily had ties to that. My great grandfather was working at Wright. In the 30s and 40s, working for Wright Aeronautical. So kind of neat that I get to work on Wright engines now and tie in with that too. But turned 16, my parents bought me a flight in a T-6 with a guy named Don Hines. He owned a T-6 and did flight programs. And I flew with him at 16. I flew with him in his Mercedes trainer fighter when I was 17. And then when I was 19, I was going to A&P school. And actually, I was 18, I think, at the time. And started hanging out. I came over to the museum because a friend of mine had known about it. And I recognized the airfield. Went and talked to Don. And he said, hey, you know, you're going to A&P school. Why don't you go talk to this other guy, Jason McNeil, who is our maintenance officer now, and he's the crew chief on the Mustang. Go talk to him, and we'll get you involved on Red Tail. So my Warbird time started working on Red Tail, wiping it down and helping with some wrenching here and there. I remember Jose from Vintage V12s coming out and showing us how to do cam fingers and torque the heads and do all that stuff. I remember being involved with that and getting involved with Red Tail. And when Don died in 2004 in the Red Tail, Amy and I, we'd met and I moved out to Seattle, got my A&P out there, didn't work in aviation. And then we came back when Don passed away. We decided to move back to Minnesota, or move to Minnesota for Amy and move back for me, and get back involved with the museum. And it was our kind of our primary goal. We both felt like we had to go back and get involved because
something was missing.
Yeah. It was, we weren't tied in anymore, and we decided we needed to be. So that's what we did.
That's awesome. And you know, the organization and the museum is a better place because of you guys. I know you personally, and I know the work that you guys do. And, the Commemorative Air Force is a great place. I mean, I always say that the CAF was saving airplanes before it was cool.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, I mean, they're the founders of I would say them and Ed Maloney were like the leaders of saving airplanes to restore to flight. So, so do you guys have a favorite moment or favorite story? Because I know these airplanes have a story, and I know that you get stories traveling. Do each of you have a favorite story from an interaction with like a veteran or family with the airplane? With the B-25.
Oh gosh.
So I got one right off.
Yeah, you go. Yeah, you go. Cause I need to think about this for a second.
It's forefront of my mind. We're looking at my wall right now, which has a bunch of pictures of different interactions and different moments of flying with these things and all our time and doing everything. Dick Cole flew our aircraft, right seat from, Madison to Oshkosh 1 year. And by far, that was the coolest thing to see for me. Dick Cole being Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot during the Doolittle raid, and he and his daughter Cindy, they were with us through that whole Oshkosh experience. And
gosh, that was such a fun time.
Yeah, it was an awesome week. We drove him around Osh and showed him, you know, just brought him wherever he wanted to go. And Al Miller, one of our pilots, he put him in the right seat, let him fly the airplane. And there's a picture that kind of summed it all up of, the two of them sitting front seats and yes, just gigantic grins on their faces. And, that was really, really, a cool thing. You know, neither one of us were on the flight. We drove in because we were hauling PX and hauling stuff and everybody else was there, but it was just awesome to be a part of the whole thing and make it happen. You know, I know Alan got told by headquarters, we got a phone call. Hey, did he let somebody fly, you know, with him in the right seat? And it's like, well, yeah. And it's Dick Cole. And they're like, well, you're not supposed to do that. And it was like, oh, just don't let it happen again. It's like, it's Dick Cole. You can't.
Yeah.
Come on.
I think the man's qualified. You know, so, that was by far one of the coolest things. Every year that we go out and are involved, there's something new and there's something really great that we don't go on the road as much as we used to. And, still when we do, we have, amazing time, amazing interactions. They're at home ones, on the road ones. And then we've got all the people that we're involved with and, you know, watching, especially the younger people that are getting involved with the organization. That is an amazing amount of fun just to watch our new pilots, our new mechanics and kind of have them grow into themselves and do it around us. It's just amazing, a blast to watch.
Yeah, so. I agree. We've had so many amazing experiences. It's hard. I might have to tell two, because one of them is like really heartfelt from this year, and the other one is my nerdy side of Star Wars and Warbirds like collided. So I'm going to start with the one first. Jim mentioned that it's really about the people. And this past year we were traveling with the B-25 and we stopped in Janesville to do some rides and be a part of their event. Before we headed to Oshkosh, and we had a guy who had purchased a flight, and it was, I think, his 15-month cancer-free anniversary and like his gift to himself. And we weren't sure if we were going to be able to do the flight because we didn't have enough people. And he got his wife signed up, and then we got one other person. And we have to have a minimum amount of people in order to fly, because otherwise we're just losing money. And we decided that, you know, we were going to, whatever we had to do, we were going to make this flight happen for him. And I have kept in touch with this couple. You know, they send me photos and they give me updates and they, you know, we chat and stuff. And just to have that level of impact in somebody's life and vice versa for them to have that level of impact in our life, like you don't, I don't know where else you can get that. Like, it's just, it's such an honor to be able to share this with so many people. And it means so much to people when just by bringing the airplane in, you know, it just, it changes people's lives. So I'm grateful for the connections that we make on the road. So, and then the second story, we were at, was it the 2012 Doolittle?
Mm-hmm, the one we met Chris at.
Yeah. The one we met you at, Chris.
Yeah.
We were with Adam and Kara from Hemlock Films, and, we're sitting, I think, behind the Doolittle Raiders because they were all in front, and they were, we were watching the flyover. And I look back and Carrie Fisher's standing there, and I'm like, oh my God, it's Princess Leia. What? And Adam, you know, because he's in the film industry, he's like, be cool, man, be cool. And I'm like, I don't think I can. Like, well, we can't just walk over to her, you know, and say, hey, I'm Amy. She, you know, her people are going to tackle us. So. So he's like, let me go talk to her people and then we'll see what we can do. And, you know, Adam made it all work and we got to, go meet Carrie Fisher, and God, it was just so cool to have like my total nerdy Star Wars side collide with the Warbirds.
Yeah.
And, you know, she gave us a hug and she was just great.
But she was there because she was shooting in the area and she'd heard about it. So she wanted to come out and meet the Doolittle Raiders, and her dad was a B-25 pilot, so she had a huge connection to the whole thing as well. So she came out and was introduced to all the Raiders, and we always laughed about it because that we overheard him say, "This is Carrie Fisher," and you could see kind of the blank looks.
What?
Yeah, the Raiders didn't really, you know, remember her from Star Wars. They probably were not connected at all to Star Wars at that point. And they said, she's, what's her name?
She's Debbie Reynolds' daughter. And they all went, oh.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
It was really funny to see their eyes light up like, oh yeah, invite her over.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. It is really wild to see worlds collide around these aircraft. And, you know, it's odd you mention, you know, cancer. We had a young woman who came in and she wanted to do pinup pictures with one of our aircraft.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as they're tasteful, we can accommodate. But I actually am the one that took the pictures, and then we had somebody else helping. But we did pinup pictures, and she came out, looked just like she rolled out of 1940s. And I thought maybe she was just an enthusiast because there's a lot of that.
Right.
And she was like, no, I'm actually not at all. Like, I mean, like she is, but like she doesn't really like do reenacting or anything. She was a cancer survivor and she just got declared cancer free. And she said, when you're battling cancer, it strips, like it took so much from all, like it just takes so much from out of you and you don't feel that you're pretty.
Sure.
And this is my way of like celebrating that, like, you know, I beat it, and to just give me something that's pretty back. You know, I mean, it was really a cool moment. Wow. That it was deeper than just doing some pinup pictures, which, you know, I usually think are really cool. And it was like, wow, this is just so different. You know, so yeah, it was a lot of meaning. And speaking of that, you know, and maybe you'll find this, but with the aircraft we have here, what I'm finding is, you know, 10, 15 years ago when we flew in, you were mobbed by the World War II vets, and that was amazing. It was a cool, cool time to get to do this. And what I'm finding now is the interest, it's not going away, it's changing. And what it is a lot of families that want to come and see and learn about their family history. And, you know, grandpa was on a B-25 or a B-17, and they want to sit where he sat, you know, and experience that sort of tangible moment. Are you guys seeing that as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, we rarely see, it's unfortunate, and it's the changing environment and reality of life, right? But we don't see a lot of World War II vets anymore when we're out on the road. We get one or two maybe at a stop, and if we're lucky, and the rest of them, it's a lot of families. It is young people though too, like, you know, that 18 to 30 year olds are coming out more in force and want to experience that exact thing. Like you said, they want to experience a piece of their history or, you know, something at least close to it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they want that tangible moment of, you know, this is what my grandpa would have been looking at, you know, and I love that because I like to explain to them a lot, especially the people who don't know, like there aren't diehard Warbird people or airplane people. Like, I love that because this whole thing is new to them. Like, they're so, sort of clean slate, don't know anything. And you can kind of explain to them and they walk away with it, realizing that their grandparents did something pretty big, you know. Yep. The airplane was 30 below zero up there and, you know, things like that. It's cool to be able to give people that, you know. You can read about it online, but it's different when you're able to come out and see it and touch it, you know.
Yeah, right. When you get to actually experience it, I think that's what makes, you know, what we do so much more impactful, because like you said, you can read about it in a textbook, or you can even see it online and watch mm-hmm. YouTube videos. But when you can actually crawl inside the airplane that your grandpa or your great grandpa even, you know, sat in, and maybe he was a bombardier, or maybe he was, you know, a radio operator, and be able to sit there and kind of feel, you know, what he went through, because it gives you a whole different perspective when you're in the airplane. Mm-hmm. I think the number one thing that I hear from people after they've toured inside the airplane is, wow, that's a lot tighter than I expected.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being in there for 10 hours being shot at? You know, and it gives people a whole new perspective of what they went through during the war.
I had the chance last year to go fly an RB-25, and it was my first B-25 flight. And, you know, I'd been on a personal journey to get healthier, and I crawled in the tunnel that goes up into the nose, which in itself was kind of emotional, because I'm like, wow, I can do this. I can get through this tunnel. Sure. I was not ready for, and I've been an airplane junkie for a long time. I was not prepared for that sight when you got into the nose and you're in flight of just how amazing of a view that is from up there.
It is.
And then I had a panic attack because I was just like, oh my God, I have to get out of here now. but in all honesty, I mean, you know, one of the things I thought about was flying in combat.
Yeah.
You know, if you took damage, I mean, you had to worry about trying to get out of this thing and get back through that tunnel up into the airplane, you know, before you could make an emergency landing or whatever. It was, you know, it's just that kind of stuff you started thinking about when you're up there. You're like, wow, these guys did this for real. And this was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that position in general, it's an amazingly awesome position to sit in, and the view is awesome, but there's no protection up there.
No. Same with the B-17. You feel very vulnerable sitting up in the bombardier seat of the B-17 in flight. You're just like, oh gosh, you can almost picture like 109s and stuff coming in at you. So,
right.
So for those wanting to learn more about the Minnesota wing of the CAF, where should they go?
So they can go to our website, which is www.cafmn.org. And it's got, you know, links to all of our social media, which you can follow us on. They can find out different information about the museum and when we're open, events that we have coming up, because we're kind of at the end of the season, but we've got two hangar dances that we usually do in June and September. And then we've got air shows that we participate in, usually from April till about the end of October. Otherwise, if you're in the Twin Cities or you're visiting, we're open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 9:30 to 5:30, and we're located at Fleming Field.
Yep, just south of St. Paul.
It's a really cool airport too.
Yeah, it is.
You know, really just a fun place. A lot of traffic, good plane watching, fantastic. Let me ask you guys. You know, on average, how many people do you fly in a year? I mean, it's really cool. You can actually buy a flight on your B-25, similar to like what we do with ours. How many people do you think you see in a year?
Flying? So this year was probably I think Andy and Denise were saying that this year was the busiest history flight year we've had, I think, ever.
Yep.
And we did 150. 50 rides, I think, in the B-25.
Yeah.
Which is...
Six riders, 150 riders or 150 ride flights?
Riders. Okay. Yeah. It might be a little bit more. I don't remember the final number.
I think it's more. We had 84 in Bemidji. Yeah.
One event. Yeah. It's been a really busy year for us.
Yeah. One event, we did 84 rides. That was huge. We usually probably do about 150, I think, for a year. And this year, I think it's
going to be closer to two.
Yeah. End up around 200. And,
We have a history flight day coming up mid-month, and we have six full rides in our crew. Like, everybody is just like, how do we have that many still so far this year?
Wow.
We've flown a lot.
Yeah.
People are into it this year. So let's go for a flight.
No, absolutely. Ike, do you have you had a question?
Yeah, I have a question. It kind of goes back to the history of your particular airplane. Sure. So one of the questions I get quite a bit about our B-17 is, was it an actual combat vet? And I tell them that it was built too late to really see combat, but I tell them that, you know, this airplane was, used a lot for mapping the Middle East and also used to haul meat, believe it or not.
Sure.
So I tell them that's kind of the case for a lot of warbirds. So what is the story behind yours? Like, was yours a combat vet, or what was the kind of the life after the war for your airplane?
The airframe itself was the same way as yours. It was a later 1944 built aircraft, December of 44. And so it didn't see combat. Never left the States. It made it through the war, as a trainer. They, went through the assembly line, stamped a T in front of the B-25J, removed the guns, and off it went. So it was used until 54, and then it ended up getting sold to, a guy named Lysdale, who was on Fleming Field, and it bounced around up in Minnesota and Wisconsin until it got donated back to us. The Miss Mitchell, the original Miss Mitchell, was a combat vet. And that's how we've not just painted it up, but we're modeling everything after the original Miss Mitchell. So we don't have oxygen tanks in it like some of the more complete restorations, because they took all the oxygen tanks out. We've got it actually painted to a specific mission, where they bombed the Brenner Pass, they won the presidential unit citation. So we try to make it look as close to that, that B-25 at that time, at that moment in history, as we can. Ours, same way. That's how most of them survived, right? You know, they didn't end up in the scrap yards. They stayed in training depots until the 50s, and then they got sold, and people were already starting to see benefits of having them for corporate operations and firebombing and all those other things that, they had lost all these potential airplanes for to scrap yards. So, luckily ours made it. We did have a combat vet to choose from. When they chose Miss Mitchell to restore, they had two other B-25s that they looked at, and one of them had combat history with the 310th Bomb Group. It ended up made in the shade. It ended up Arizona's B-25. And the reason we didn't pick that one was we had a maintenance officer named Gene Andriotti, and he was a B-29 flight engineer during the war. He ended up a chief in the Air Force, working on C-97s, and his son ended up a general in the Air Force. Pretty amazing family history there. And Gene went out to this B-25. We had a B-25 that was privately owned prior to that, called I See No Problem. He went out to this B-25, what's now made in the shade, and he was poking around in the stress panels underneath, and he put his finger right through the stress panel and said, I see a problem. And that became the nose art for it. They spray painted I See a Problem on the side of it, And eventually it got shipped down to Arizona, and that took a 25-year restoration to get that thing running. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. When you talk about keeping them running, Jim, you know, what's probably the biggest maintenance hurdle for you and keeping Miss Mitchell airworthy?
Engines.
Hands down.
Yeah, the right engine is not a particularly reliable engine, this 2600 specifically. It's, you know, the 2800 is from Pratt is a great engine. It is reliable. Its horsepower to cubic inch makes it a lot more reliable. And the right just is, it's rough. We go through engines far too regularly. There are only three engine builders out there now. And, you know, I know they're doing their absolute best to make it not only cost effective, but reliable, but, you know, parts are getting older. And the talent that used to be out there, the knowledge that used to be out there is fading very quickly. And so, you know, we're all kind of in it together, right? You know, the builders rely on us to purchase engines, and we rely on the builders to build the engines. So there's a lot of work going on between all of us constantly to make sure things go as smoothly as they can. But, you know, it just is the reality of the game. We, you know, we struggle with that. You know, beyond that, the airframe, it's normal maintenance. It's a very, very, reliable aircraft, lots of, redundancy throughout it. It's about as safe as they get, you know, just from a standpoint of, you know, its capability and even, you know, with the horsepower that those engines have, it still does pretty well, single engine. It can, you know, make things happen for itself. So if we have any problems with an engine, that having that backup is good. But yeah, just rising costs, rising fuel costs, rising insurance costs. And, those are the big, you know, regulation, which is necessary, but, you know, it can become overbearing as well. And all of those things become a risk to our continuing to operate. EAA is continuing to operate, I know too. And, you know, we're starting to see more people communicating together. You know, I regularly talk to other operators, and we talk about the problems that we're having. We're trying to get more of a conclave together and create new parts if we need to, you know, make sure that what we need is out there and available to each other, and keep each other flying. It's not as competitive as I kind of remember it being earlier in my career. It's more about, hey, you know, we're all in this together, and we need to make sure that we help each other out where we can. And that has been really nice about the community. It's been pretty easy to have that attitude and have other people jump right on board. It helps having pilots that fly multiple aircraft. And so, you know, when you got a guy who's flying Miss Mitchell and Yellow Rose and Berlin Express and Rosie's Reply, and, you know, he goes, oh yeah, well, over at Minnesota Wing, we do this. And they go, I hadn't thought of that. And they call us and talk to us about it, and we do the same. It helps out a lot. So,
well, you know, it's funny you mentioned I was out, I got to go out with Doc, the B-29, and it was very similar. We're, you know, a much smaller community, of course. There's only two B-29s that fly, but they were, you know, a lot of these guys had been in crewed on both aircraft, and they would kind of compare notes, or I learned this on Fifi, and, you know, we could use this on Doc, or vice versa, you know, and right. It was pretty cool. And what you're talking about, you know, I think that's also the, you know, the spirit of like NWOC, the National Warbird Operator Conference, yeah. Where, you know, a lot of great minds in the room, we're all, you know, rowing the same way, you know, we're all in the same boat. And it was really, last year was my first one with you guys, and it was cool. It was just really, you know, there's a lot of brain power in that room and a lot of experience, and it was really cool to see everybody kind of come together with advice. And you know, like you said, it wasn't competitive. It was a more team building than anything.
Right.
And that was super cool.
Yep.
Too small of a community to not be helpful to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I know we're fighting the clock here. I want to say thank you guys for everything. I mean, not just doing what you did during Air Venture with the Make-A-Wish, but for being great ambassadors of the aircraft, for bringing new people and young blood into this, and for just being great friends. It was this selfishly felt like just like a phone call that we would normally have. So, but seriously, thank you guys. Thank you for everything you're doing out there every day. And please, if you're out in the area or if you're not in the area, go check out our friends at the Minnesota wing of the CAF. You won't regret it. It's an amazing museum, amazing airplane. It's one of my favorite B-25s that's flying. It's only second because I got to fly in ours. So, I mean, it's up there. So, but seriously, thank you guys for all that you do. And when this goes live, I'll send you guys links. Hopefully you get some traffic and people want to come up and see you all.
Sounds great.
Sounds good. Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. And for all those listening, if you have any questions or anything like that, send us emails to feedback@ea.org. And if you have questions for Jim and Amy, we'll make sure we get those forwarded over to them. And thank you always for the comments and great feedback you give us. It's the listeners that really help keep this going. So we're really thankful for all of you spending some time with you. I always like the comments from people that say, I had to go out and mow the yard. So you guys, I think I've mowed more yards than ever because people always tell me that they put the earbuds in and listen to us while they're out doing chores and stuff. But we appreciate it. We'll come along on those chores. We're happy to do it. So, thank you guys. And we'll catch you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.